about this session. Skeptics insist that the evidence makes it impossible for Mormons to confront thorny historical and doctrinal questions with their faith intact. But just as there's more than one way to Mormon, there's also more than one way to ex-Mormon. Jim Bennett explores the multiplicity of legitimate ways to evaluate the truth claims of the church and looks for opportunities for people across the entire Mormon spectrum to find common ground. Jim Bennett is an LDS writer and blogger whose response to the CES letter has been downloaded over 100,000 times. He is one of the co-founders of the United Utah Party and ran as its first candidate in 2017 and became the most successful third-party congressional candidate in Utah history. He currently works for canonizer.com, a website designed to amplify the wisdom of the crowd and find consensus on controversial issues. And now for the presentation.
Very much. Do I need to raise this? It's like a podium at a sacrament meeting. Thank you very much. Glad to see some of you here. I'm glad to see all of you here, but I'm glad to see that there are some people here, is my point. My ensemble today was inspired by this graphic that appeared on the ex-Mormon Reddit yesterday. When you have a prophet, what the hell do you need all these apologists for? And there I am. And I thought, I'm very impressed with myself that I actually made the list. I'm not nearly as big as Daniel Peterson, but I'm about as big as Hugh Nibley, which I think is really kind of impressive. But what I always think about in these pictures is that you never see their feet. So I decided that I would wear the ensemble with some Chacos and see what that would do for my presentation. So yes, I appreciate that introduction. Most people know me for who I'm related to, which is just kind of the way I live. Here at Sunstone, I can drop names. My first cousin, Peggy Fletcher Stack, was the founding editor of Sunstone, so Sunstone holds a very special place in my heart. But people usually recognize me for my father, Senator Bob Bennett. But he was not the first politician in our family. That honor goes to a man named Daniel H. Wells, who was the third mayor of Salt Lake City. His nephew was the first governor of Utah, and he was also a member of the first presidency under Brigham Young. But prior to coming west, Daniel H. Wells was a practicing attorney in Illinois at the same time as Abraham Lincoln. And the story goes that Wells and Lincoln met each other, and Daniel H. Wells approached Abraham Lincoln and said, "You, sir, are a marked man, for I swore to myself, if I ever met a man who was uglier than I was, I would shoot him on sight." To which Abraham Lincoln replied, "Shoot away. If I'm uglier than you, I don't want to live." So, and I was told that when I was told how much I look like Daniel H. Wells. I don't know. That's kind of a rough sort of assembly there. But a lot of people make assumptions about my background, too. They assume I grew up in Salt Lake City, and the fact is I actually grew up in Southern California. My parents grew up in Salt Lake City. They moved to Washington, D.C., where I was born, and we moved to California when I was 6 years old. And I grew up in Calabasas, which most people know as the home of the Kardashians. I was there before they were. But I want to begin this presentation with a story from Calabasas from my youth that may not seem like it applies, but it gets to the principle I'm talking about and involves these two guys. These are how I remember them. This is from the 1982-83 Calabasas yearbook. Steve Redman and Robert Rosencrantz. In 1985... Calabasas was in the national news because of these two young men. And the story is that Robert Rosencrantz was, let me back up a little bit. I just lost my train of thought. Steve Redman was my age. He was in my class. Robert Rosencrantz was 1 year older. We were on the debate team together, so I actually probably knew Robert better than I knew Steve. What I did not know is that Robert Rosencrantz was gay. And in 1985, it was not acceptable to be gay in any stretch of the imagination. But Steve Redman had information, and he knew that Robert Rosencrantz was gay and was blackmailing him. And at one point, Steve Redman went to Robert Rosencrantz's father and told Robert's father that Robert was gay, and Robert got kicked out of the house. And this is 1985, and that was not at all unusual, unfortunately. And so Robert decided to take action on this. Robert went out and bought a semi-automatic Uzi and waited outside of Steve's house for 5 hours. Steve came home. Robert confronted Steve, and Robert shot him 10 times, point-blank range, 4 times directly in the head. Now, I tell this story when I used to work for a nonprofit that taught a cognitive behavioral model to probationers and parolees, and we would tell this story, and I would say, okay, these are the facts as I've outlined them. Robert bought an Uzi. Robert drove to Steve's home with the Uzi. Robert waited for 5 hours for Steve to come home. Robert confronted Steve, and Robert shot Steve 10 times, 4 times in the head. And when I teach this class to the probationers and parolees, I tell them, the trial for Robert Rosencrantz lasted 3 weeks. Now the question is, all of these facts were stipulated at the beginning of the trial. The defense conceded that all of these things actually happened. Nobody tried to pretend that somebody else shot Steve, that Robert was insane, that, you know, that this is a case of mistaken identity or something, or self-defense. All of these things were stipulated at the trial. So the question I would ask is, what did they talk about for 3 weeks? I'll pose that question to you. Does anybody have any idea? What do you think they talked about for 3 weeks? Am I allowed to pose questions before the Q&A? Anybody have any ideas? All the facts that aren't listed there? State of mind. State of mind. Okay, elaborate on that a little bit.
Put it in context.
Right.
He felt abused.
Right.
He
was
wrong, so he had to rectify the wrong.
Okay. Well, that's true. Well, the... Extreme emotional distress. Okay. And all of that stuff was discussed at the trial. The focus of the trial was on the difference between first and second degree murder. Does anybody know the difference between first and second degree murder? Premeditation is the primary difference, right? First degree murder is premeditated. You plan the murder in advance. Second degree murder happens on the spot. You intend to kill the person. You intend to murder them, but that decision is not made until the heat of the moment, right? And, you know, there are all kinds of different gradations of how you treat one person killing another person. If I'm driving on a foggy night and I run over somebody, I've killed them just as surely as Robert killed Steve, but I had no intention of killing them. And the law does not prosecute me in a way where I'm held accountable for killing them in the same way that Robert was being held accountable. So the entire focus of the trial was whether or not this constituted first-degree murder. First degree being premeditation, second degree being a crime of passion, something that happens in the spur of the moment. So based on the facts that I have given you, I'm going to take an informal poll. How many of you would say that Robert, who waited for 5 hours for Steve to come home, was guilty of first-degree murder? I've got most of you. Okay. How many would say second degree? Okay. Why second degree? Anybody? But go ahead.
Because there was a passion involved before he showed up.
Okay.
He was, I'm sure, very agitated. And he probably, it's a big deal to shoot somebody. He was ready to shoot somebody.
Right. Okay. Well, the difference between a first degree and a second degree murder sentence was, yes. Okay. Right. Okay. Yes. Hi, George. Right. There was a lot of preparation involved in this. Right.
He's going to take care of this guy.
Right.
You gave us five facts about Robert, and not one fact about Steve.
Okay. That's a good point. All right. Well, you asked about the conversation. Was it you? You asked about the conversation. I can give you Robert's report of the conversation almost verbatim. I hope you don't mind profanity as I give this. At Sunstone, you're allowed to. Okay, but I'm going to quote. Special dispensation. But I'm going to. My sons are here, but I'm quoting. Please don't be upset. According to Robert, who took the stand, he said that he confronted Steve and said, this is what you're going to do. You're going to go to my father, and you're going to tell him it was all a lie and that you made it all up, and you're going to do it or I'm going to shoot you in the head. And according to Robert, Steve laughed in his face and said, no way, you fucking faggot. And those were Steve's last words. And that's when Robert opened fire. And Robert was convicted of second-degree murder. And the key piece of evidence that determined that was the 10 shots. The jury determined that if Robert's intent was to go and kill Steve, there wouldn't have been a conversation. He would have. Anybody ever seen the movie Road to Perdition? It's a great movie. Tom Hanks, he goes and kills Daniel Craig. He spends the entire movie hunting for Daniel Craig, finally finds him in a bathroom, opens the door, shoots him once, walks away, and leaves the bloody corpse. And the jury determined that that's what first-degree murder looks like. Robert said, I absolutely prepared for this. He said, I was even willing to shoot up his car, but I had no intention of killing him. And he said, and the fact that Steve laughed in my face was clear that he didn't believe that I was capable of killing him. And the jury took that as the evidence, and the jury said, okay, they convicted him of second-degree murder. And incidentally, Robert served 21 years. Every time he came up for parole, Gray Davis was up for re-election in California. And Gray Davis personally rejected his parole request twice. He came up for parole every 7 years. He was released after 21 years. He now lives in Colorado. He has a college degree that he earned in prison. He was a model prisoner and all of this kind of thing. And he was actually my Facebook friend for a while until he got really, really rude, and then I defriended him for non-murder reasons. But the reason I tell you this story is that this illustrates, I think, as starkly as possible, that you can have a common set of facts with two valid interpretations of those facts. And the facts don't change, right? All of the facts I gave you, I can tell you more about Steve. Actually, most people who heard about this were more sympathetic to Robert than Steve, because Steve was a really unpleasant human being. He did not deserve to be shot in the head four times. But the fact that he was blackmailing Robert and that he was all of these kinds of things. And Robert, you know, I mean, you look at this and there are so many ways to interpret these events, but you have this common set of facts. Well, so this brings me to why I have sort of risen to prominence in the Mormon apologetic world. I don't consider myself an apologist, but that's a whole other discussion we'll get into. But it comes to my CES letter reply. And Jeremy Reynolds has told me that this is the one image he hates more than any other that I put in the CES letter reply. You have Jeremy Reynolds as Joseph Smith, the mighty man. And here's Jim Bennett, the hobo, coming after him with the CES letter reply. But to give you a little bit of background on why I wrote this and how I wrote this, the CES letter was sort of on the periphery of my perception. I just kind of kept hearing about it, but didn't pay much attention to it until members of my extended family started leaving the church over it. And I thought, oh boy, well, this must be a really big deal. And I read it, and I thought, okay, I'm not particularly impressed with this, because the thing about it that really struck me as problematic is that he presents facts and he also presents what he considers to be the only possible interpretation of those facts. There's no other way to look at these troubling aspects of church history except the way Jeremy Reynolds does in the CES letter. I mean, that's the tone of the whole thing. And to give you a little more background on my own sort of faith journey, when I was 18 years old, I was a freshman at the University of Southern California. and I got a copy of The God Makers, which I told Jeremy was the CES letter of its day. And he insists, no, God Makers is terrible and my thing's great. But The God Makers is where I was exposed to the Kinderhook plates, for instance, where I was exposed to polygamy, Joseph Smith's polygamy and young wives and all of those sorts of things. And I was deeply troubled by it. And I had two advantages that a lot of people who go through these kinds of faith crises do not have. One is that I had a father and I had an uncle. My uncle was Howard Anderson, who was the LA stake president, who was just a wonderful human being, and I was actually living with him at the time. And they were patient enough to walk me through every single one of my concerns that I stumbled onto in The God Makers. And they actually had looked like they'd confronted these. And my family had moved back to Salt Lake City after I graduated from high school. And I went home for Christmas. And out of the blue, in Elders Quorum, this guy said, hey, have any of you ever heard of The God Makers? Well, there's a guy who's written a book called The Truth About The God Makers. And they had copies of it, and they passed them out in Elders Quorum. I've never seen that happen before. But I read The Truth About The God Makers by Gilbert W. Sharfs, which was sort of a line-by-line refutation of The God Makers. And what it did for me, what that experience did for me, was not say, aha, The God Makers is completely wrong, and here are all the answers. Gilbert W. Sharfs knows everything, and now all of my concerns are completely assuaged. I don't have to worry about this anymore. That was not the response. My response was, okay, my father, my uncle, and Gilbert W. Sharfs are all intelligent, kind, thoughtful people. And they have all looked at these issues, and they have been able to reconcile themselves with them. And knowing that was enough to allow me the space to be able to find my own answers to them. And that, I think, was a far more powerful, far more valuable experience than if I had gone into some kind of debate with somebody where they were trying to prove to me that The God Makers was pure anti-Mormon evil, and here are all the correct answers and all that kind of thing. And that, I think, tends to be the dynamic that happens when people encounter difficult truths. I get very frustrated with what I think is the flawed institutional church response that we're seeing recently. Elder Renlund's talk, where he talks about doubters being similar to people who are rescued from a lifeboat, but they don't want to drink out of a dirty canteen, they only want to drink Perrier, and then they jump out and the sharks eat them. And that's a terrible, terrible way to deal with controversy and to deal with these kind of faith crises, and I think it exacerbates the problem more than it solves it. So with that background, I read the CES letter, and I've been a blogger for about 10 years, and I'd written on, my blog wasn't all Mormon. It was political. It was pop culture. I ranked the Star Trek movies, that kind of thing. But I'd written enough about Mormon issues that as I went through the CES letter, I said, I've written an article about that. And I'd go and then sort of cut and paste through the CES letter, and I went through it line by line and eventually ended up fleshing it out with a lot of original stuff because there was stuff in there that was not right from my blog. And I published it on April 1st, 2016, and a note of caution, if you want something taken seriously, do not ever publish it on April 1st. Not a good idea. But I published it, and it quickly went viral. I quickly got all kinds of responses from people who said it had been very helpful, that they had read the CES letter. The CES letter had devastated them, and they didn't see any kind of answer to it. They'd gone to Fair Mormon, and they weren't happy with what had happened there. But the response that I got that was so encouraging was that it was similar to the kind of response that I had had to the God Makers. It was not, oh, gee, Jim Bennett, you have all the answers. I'm so glad you have all the answers. It was, oh, gee, Jim Bennett, I'm so happy that you were able to look at this and come up with a response to it, that you were able to navigate this. I don't get a whole lot of messages from people who say, you've answered every single one of my questions, and I know the church is absolutely true. I get messages saying, thank you very much for modeling a way for me to be able to stay faithful, even in the face of all of the difficult issues. So that, I think, has kind of been my entire approach, as I've entered into this world, because I fully accept and recognize that my interpretation of the facts about church history is not the definitive interpretation. I don't know that there is such a thing. I don't know that there is a definitive interpretation. But my interpretation of these facts demonstrates, I think, the principle that it is possible to be able to maintain your faith and have a deep and rich faith experience with all of the facts in Mormon history and in Mormon doctrine and practice, and still be able to maintain your intellectual integrity. And I think there is a hunger for that out there, for people in the church who read the CES letter and feel like chumps because they buy into Jeremy's idea that this is the only way to be able to interpret these facts. There's no other way but to assume that the church is a complete and total fraud and that the entire thing is a house of cards, and I hate it and I have to leave it. And they look at that and they don't want to leave it because they've had sacred and wonderful experiences in it, and they want to know if there's some way to be able to reconcile these things with their faith. So let me give you a specific example of what I'm talking about rather than just talking generalities. This is a graphic that appears in the first version of the CES letter. He's taken it out in the second one. But 14 times in the CES letter, Jeremy Runnels uses the phrase, a rock and a hat. I think one of the things that really devastated him when he discovered it was the idea that Joseph Smith was not using the Nephite, Urim, and Thummim interpreters and staring at the gold plates while he was translating the Book of Mormon. He took his seer stone, which is an ordinary rock, stuck it in a top hat and looked in that and dictated it. That's what happened for most of the Book of Mormon. And this graphic says, ancient prophets went through all the trouble of engraving, storing, compiling, hiding, and protecting the gold plates. And Moroni even came back as an angel. Also, Joseph Smith could translate them just by peering at a rock in a hat. Now, you read that, right. And there are plenty of people who read that and say, yes, absolutely. I read that and I said, okay, so what? That doesn't change any part of the text of the Book of Mormon for me. It doesn't change anything about the experience of the Book of Mormon for me. That is not to say that Jeremy Runnels' response to that and other people's response to that is illegitimate or wrong, but to me, I look at this and say, this is a complete and total non-issue. My father, near the end of his life, he had pancreatic cancer and he was planning on moving back to Utah and decided to stay in Washington, D.C. after he left the Senate to get treatment for pancreatic cancer. But my father in 2009 had written a book called Leap of Faith, Confronting the Origins of the Book of Mormon. I think it's still available at Deseret Book. It may be out of print. But he was frustrated, especially during the 2002 Olympics, by all of the reporters who would talk about the Book of Mormon as an obvious fraud. And he said, no, the evidence for the Book of Mormon is much stronger than that. And he wrote this book to talk about that. You're shaking your head. I understand. You don't have to agree with me. I'm not asking you to agree with me. I'm just presenting to you my thesis here. But the whole idea, so near the end of his life, when he fell ill with pancreatic cancer, he got an assignment to do a fireside in the Arlington ward. And he was fading fast, and he kept saying, I've just got to stay alive for the fireside. My entire life leads up to this fireside. I've got to stay alive for the fireside. And they want him to speak about the book that he'd written. And on April 10th, 2016, my father stood up without any notes and gave a 45-minute fireside about the Book of Mormon. The next morning, he had a stroke, and he was dead 3 weeks later. So this was his final sermon and his final message. And it can really be summed up very, very succinctly. He said, the Book of Mormon exists. That means somebody wrote it. It's here. It's physical. It cannot be waved away. And his experience, he worked for Howard Hughes during the Hughes will, you know, when Melvin Dumar showed up at church headquarters with a will from Howard Hughes giving him, he's a gas station attendant, and he got 1/14th of the Hughes estate in this will. And all of the Hughes people looked at this and said, it's nonsense for a number of reasons. One, the will mentions the spruce goose, which was Howard Hughes's flying boat. And the spruce goose was a term that was given to this flying boat by the press that Howard Hughes hated. There's no possible way Howard Hughes would have written a will where he'd have used the phrase the spruce goose. And he also goes through in this book the idea, Howard Hughes was also subject to another forgery. There was a guy named Clifford Irving, who was a novelist, who got his hands on a book or a manuscript about the inner workings of the Hughes Empire. And he incorporated that into a fake biography, autobiography of Howard Hughes. And Howard Hughes had not been seen in public for years. He was in the Bahamas in hiding. And so everybody kind of thought, well, this is something weird enough that Howard Hughes would actually do. And Dad was working for Hughes at the time, and they were trying very hard to prove that this wasn't true and went through all this. But Dad applies all of those kinds of things to the Book of Mormon, and he says, you know, the book forgeries are more ridiculous over time, whereas the Book of Mormon actually becomes more credible over time. There are anachronisms in the Book of Mormon, but there are actually fewer than there were at the time the Book of Mormon was written. Again, you don't have to agree with this. I'm just giving you his thesis. But so as he went through this, this has kind of become my understanding of it. The rock in the hat doesn't do anything to discredit any of that kind of thing. Yes, sir.
It's not just the rock in the hat.
Right.
The rock in the hat plus a thousand
right.
plus other
things. Right. Well, let me point out to you that I'm not trying to tell you that you're wrong. If you are upset about the rock in the hat, I think that's an entirely legitimate, and if you are upset about the thousands of other things, I think that is an entirely legitimate interpretation. Right, right. Well, right. What I'm trying to point out is not that you, the way you are looking at the evidence is illegitimate or is wrong. I'm trying to point out that there is another way to look at the evidence. And you may not agree with the way I am looking at the evidence. And you are welcome to not agree with how I'm looking at the evidence. But the thing that frustrated me about the CES letter is that it is premised on the idea that there is only one way to look at this evidence. And there is not a thoughtful, intelligent, intellectually integritous way, is that a word, to look at this evidence and still maintain your faith. And my father's position and my position is that there is, that you can do that. Now, right. I'll keep going. But where I hope to get with this presentation is in the idea where you and I can sit down and you can say, I can't accept this, and I say I can, and we can break bread as brothers. I mean, because that I think is the problem. The goal of this is not to convince you the CES letter is wrong. The goal of this is not to convince you that you are wrong for leaving the church. The goal is not. No, I'm not trying to attack Runnels. I understand that. I understand that. Well, I'm not trying to present what he said as illegitimate. I fully. Okay, I apologize for that, because that's not my intent. My intent here is to try to figure out a way where you and I and people who disagree.
What he said was legitimate, right?
Yes.
It's a legitimate concern.
No, it's absolutely a legitimate concern. I don't think the CES letter is filled with illegitimate concerns. I think the CES letter is filled with facts that are subject to multiple interpretations. Justice, I don't think the people who thought Robert Rosencrantz was guilty of first-degree murder are wrong or are illegitimate in that opinion. Right, he was. Right. Well, okay, so Joseph Smith was guilty of looking at a rock in a hat. Okay, how do you interpret that? What does that do to your faith? For some people, it's ridiculous and it drives them out of the church, which is an entirely valid response. For me, for my father, this doesn't explain what we consider to be the miracle of the Book of Mormon. And it doesn't do anything to shake my faith. Now, I think both of those reactions are legitimate. My purpose here is not to demonize Jeremy Runnels.
You showed us a cartoon of him.
Oh, okay. I did show you a cartoon of him. I'll show you another picture of him later on that may be more helpful. Anyway, we'll get to that. All right. So the CES letter response led to a guy on Facebook that I didn't know, but he said, you know, I'd really love to see you go toe-to-toe with Bill Reel. And I didn't even know who Bill Reel was. And my response was, well, I'm happy to have a conversation with Bill Reel, but I don't want to go toe-to-toe with anyone. It is not my goal to debate anybody. It is not my goal to convince you that the church is true. I don't see that as my role, but I am happy to talk to anybody. And I got a call from Bill Reel, who said, I think that would be great. I think that would be wonderful. And so over the course of 3 weeks, we recorded 6 different podcasts, each of which, they were supposed to last an hour. They each lasted at least 2. There's over 15 hours of material. And this was all being recorded. I was very happy with these conversations. I thought they were a very good give and take. And in the second one, Bill Reel said to me, you know, people listening to this are probably going to think you won this round. And I laughed because I thought he was actually making a joke. And I said, well, I hope they don't think that anybody won, that that's not what this is about. Am I doing okay? And I said, I hope nobody thinks that's what this is about. This is a conversation. This is not a debate. And over again, I would say to him, you know, I can fully understand your point of view. I can fully see this as legitimate. The one issue that really got interesting early on was the Book of Abraham. Because I started talking about the Book of Abraham, my perspective on the Book of Abraham, and he said, well, let me read you a statement by Brian Haglund, where Brian Haglund calls all of the apologetics on the Book of Abraham abhorrent. This is the editor of the Joseph Smith papers on the Book of Abraham. And I hadn't seen that. I was sort of blindsided by it. And I ended up making the statement, I said, look, the Book of Abraham is really problematic for me, and if it weren't for the Book of Mormon, I look at the Book of Abraham through the prism of the Book of Mormon. If the Book of Abraham came to us in a vacuum, I would probably reject it as a fraud. And those were the kinds of discussions we had, and they were published all at once, and we just sort of braced ourselves and waited for the response to them. And I was extraordinarily disappointed in Bill Reel's reaction. I have not met Bill Reel. I don't know him personally. But Bill Reel went all over the internet, essentially, and said, here's my debate with Jim Bennett, and look how much ground he gave up. Look how I won this debate. And he sent me this message where he said, Jim, you shouldn't feel bad. You did as well as anyone could in defending the church. But the fact is, the church is indefensible, and this experience will clearly have the end result of people losing their faith. You have participated in a project that will erode people's faith. And that was devastating to me. Because first of all, it wasn't a debate in my mind. And second of all, Radio Free Mormon made this list with Bill Reel of all the places I'd given up ground, including, for instance, the Book of Abraham. That Jim Bennett says, in a vacuum, the Book of Abraham clearly looks like a fraud. And I said, well, yes, I said that, and I believe that, but I don't believe the Book of Abraham came to us in a vacuum, and anyone listening to us in the context of the conversation wouldn't understand how it is that I accept the Book of Abraham as Scripture and how I reconcile that with my faith. And I had hoped that that would have been the tone, the tenor of the conversation, and instead Bill Reel took it as, aha, I have won, I have defeated the apologists, victory is mine. And we had a 7th conversation. Now, I don't know how many of you have listened to any of these, but if you go back and listen to the first 6, you will find that the tone of the first 6 is quite different from the 7th. Because in the 7th, I said, Bill, you have made it impossible for anyone to have this kind of conversation ever again. Because instead of you and me expressing our points of view and recognizing the legitimacy of each other's points of view, this is a debate now. This is always a fight. This is always who wins, who loses. And I felt like my empathy had been weaponized against me. That, you know, every time I'd say, oh, I can see your point of view. That's a legitimate point of view. It was, aha, see, Jim Bennett has given up ground. Jim Bennett has thrown the church under the bus. And that drove me nuts. And so the Bill Real experience is one of the reasons why I wanted to do this presentation today, is that, let me back up. I don't want to show you that yet. Sorry. I thought there was another slide in between.
We couldn't read it anyway.
Good. Good. One of the most interesting things that happened as a result of the Bill Real experience was I got an email from Jeremy Runnels. I had never met Jeremy Runnels. I didn't know Jeremy Runnels. In my first version of the CES letter, I kept talking about how I wanted to meet Jeremy Runnels and sit down and talk to him, and that was absolutely legitimate. That was absolutely true. But Jeremy Runnels, the quickest way for, I don't know if this is still true, but the quickest way to get banned from Jeremy Runnels' Facebook page was to post a link to my CES letter reply. I saw people do this in real time. It's like, well, Jim Bennett's replied to your thing, and it would be deleted, and all of a sudden they were banned, and they couldn't look at his page again. But right after, not long after these six episodes were published, I got an email from Jeremy Runnels, which Jeremy has given me permission to read to you. You can't see it, so I will take this here. It's pretty good, so I want to give you the whole sense of it. Jim, just wanted to thank you for doing the interviews with Bill. You really stepped into it big time and hung yourself with a lot of rope. I mean, shockingly, a lot of rope. I couldn't have asked for anything better, and it couldn't have happened to a nicer guy. It's obvious that you're way out of your league and way over your head here, and your foundation isn't as steady or strong as you once thought it was. Your shelf is sagging, and it couldn't have been more obvious than it was in part six of your interview with Bill. You said so many damning and forehead-slapping, cringing things that it would be criminal for me not to finish the job you started in nailing shut the Bennett coffin. It's unfortunate you went the unchristlike path in attacking me personally and viciously and in a mean-spirited way. It really wasn't necessary, and you're paying the price for it, and will continue to pay the price for it as your reputation solidifies as that obnoxiously smug Mormon apologist with gold medal mental gymnastics who led a lot of people out of the church. You don't realize it, or you just refuse to see it, but you have played a major role in bringing many people out of the church by introducing them to the CES letter Mormon Church's Truth Crisis, with not just your asinine philosophies of men mingled with scripture theories, claims, faithful answers, but your juvenile, unchristlike behavior and rancid smugness and arrogance. I have received emails and comments from person after person after person who have pointed to you and your response as a major factor in pushing them over the fence in leaving the church. One of the reasons why I saw no urgency or rushed need these past few years to respond to your nonsense was that your nonsense was destroying testimonies and doing the opposite of your intended goals. It was, is, doing a wonderful job on its own in self-destruction. And then he quotes a guy who says, knowing that he had a rebuttal to the CES letter gave me all the courage to read it. I trust that he, Jim Bennett, would be able to call Jeremy on all his anti-Mormon lies. After reading the letter and his rebuttal, it was clear. He confirmed the same facts in the CES letter and then gave flimsy excuses for it. I am glad Fair Mormon is promoting his rebuttal. I think it will lead more people out than it convinces to say. Reddit comment. This is your real legacy, Jim. This is the bed you made, and I am enthusiastically going to help you finally sleep in it. Cheers, Jeremy. All right, so what? He's clearly angry. Here is my first response. This was the beginning of a long chain. What a pleasant message. If you could highlight any specific instances where I have attacked you personally rather than your arguments, please let me know, and I will be happy to apologize for them. Bill and I are recording a final podcast, so this was before the 7th. Bill and I are recording a final podcast where we will sum up our entire discussion, and I would be more than willing to apologize publicly then. I look forward to reading more about how awful I am in your upcoming response. Best to you and yours, Jim. I won't give you the rest of them. They weren't quite as long and weren't quite as good. But Jeremy shot back, oh no, your jig is up. And I shot back, no, I have not yet begun to jig. And, I finally went, okay, Jeremy, no one's reading these but us. You know, talking trash at me when there's no audience but me, what do you hope to accomplish? I mean, and he's like, well, I know you don't believe in this. And I said, no, I'm pretty sure I know what I believe. And there isn't anybody else watching this. And so I don't understand why we're doing this. But it still went on for a while. And finally, I sent him this one. Hey, you live in American Fork and I live in Sandy. Perhaps I could apologize over burgers I'm buying. And that completely disarmed him. And here's us at Cubby's in American Fork. Our lunch lasted 3 hours. And the only reason it ended is because both of us had other things we had to do. We had intended to do this for an hour. But I went and talked to him, and we talked niceties and pleasantries, and it was a little uncomfortable. And finally he said to me, "All right, Jim, tell me why you went after me." And I went, "Okay, let's talk." And we started talking back and forth. And I discovered something, which was that I like Jeremy Runnels. I think Jeremy Runnels is a great guy. I disagree with Jeremy Runnels. Jeremy Runnels disagrees with me. But the thing, the tone of that initial email and that initial exchange and the kinds of things you see online when people on both sides of this issue, it's just stunning how unnecessary it is and how unproductive it is. You know, Jeremy Runnels is not going to convince me to leave the church in a series of nasty emails. I'm not going to convince Jeremy Runnels to come back to church with my CES letter reply. But I think the goal in all of this needs to be a way for us to be able to talk to each other without hating each other, and a way for us to be able to acknowledge the legitimacy of people on all sides of these issues. Because there isn't just the church interpretation and the Exmo interpretation. As we see at Sunstone, there are all kinds of different ways to interpret the facts of church history and church doctrine. And we need to respect and recognize the legitimacy of those ways, even if we don't agree with it. Now, I am fully willing to concede that the church is terrible at this, that the church very much goes out of its way in most circumstances. Maybe not even, I think you see this on a local level. It's a bit of leader roulette more than anything else. But people who leave the church get hounded or get, you know, they just wanted to sin. They're just terrible people. You know, they're jumping over the lifeboat because they didn't get Perrier. And I think that's a terrible way for the church to respond to doubters. And I think that drives more people out than it keeps in. But I think people on the outside, in my interaction with people, you don't do anybody any favors. So I went to the ex-Mormon Reddit, which I sort of peruse every once in a while. I made the mistake when I first published my reply of diving in to talk to the people on the ex-Mormon Reddit, and I got beat up enough that I finally went, no, this isn't any good. But I was just perusing it, and I bumped into that picture I showed you at the beginning of, with all the apologists and saw me in there, and I went, hey, there I am. That's pretty cool. Thanks, guys. And that was, yeah, you lame apologists are all jerks. And I went, okay, this isn't helpful to anybody. I mean, what do you think you're accomplishing by insulting me when I come in here? Can't we talk? Can't we be friends? We don't have to agree. You don't have to come to church. I don't have to leave the church. Anyway, so a couple of other interesting things have happened as a result of all of this, and then I'll take some questions. Am I running out of time? I got 15 minutes. I work for a site called canonizer.com, and the head of the site is a guy named Brent Alsop, who describes himself as, he's one of the founders of the Mormon Transhumanist Association. He describes himself as a Mormon transhumanist atheist. And he's really interested in consensus. And he saw my work with the United Utah Party. And he said, this site is a Wikipedia with camps, where people join different camps, different articles that they support. And those camps rise to the top so you can see where the consensus is. And so I revised my CES letter reply and started posting it on Canonizer in order to be able to try to get people to get involved with this interface. The problem is that the interface is kind of clunky. It's still sort of in a beta mode. So I'm working on a new project, which I'm going to be unveiling here, where I'm actually going line by line through Bruce R. McConkie's Mormon Doctrine, which I think is going to be kind of fun. But the idea, so Canonizer is designed to be able to create consensus out of controversy, and that's kind of happened as a result of this. And another thing happened. Robert Reynolds is here. Can you wave to everybody? Robert Reynolds is directing a film called An Inconvenient Faith. This is not the official logo for the film, but I made it when the church, that's the logo for the church formerly known as Mormon. Robert Reynolds contacted me right after he'd heard the Bill Real podcast and got me involved in this documentary that, from my perspective, is doing what I tried to describe, which is it shows people who are wrestling with difficult issues in the church, and it shows how they do it. It certainly does not try to show, okay, this is the only right answer, and it shows people on both sides. But it models how it is that people live with an inconvenient faith. And, that's really small. I listed a lot of the people who are involved. You got Lindsey Hansen Park, Jeremy Runnels, Richard Bushman, John DeLynn, Senator Harry Reid, Darius Gray, John Gustav Rathall, Spencer Fluman, Patrick Mason, Kendall Wilcox, Greg Prince, Sandra Tanner, and many more. Usually when you see "and many more," that doesn't mean there really are many more, but there really are many more. And there are some big heavy hitters that I didn't want to list because we haven't filmed them yet. But this is a project we're involved in. And this, I think, is the only way I see the church can move forward. The days when it was possible to ignore difficult issues or to ignore people who left or to shame people who left and just carry on, those days are gone, and they're not coming back. In the age of the internet, the idea that the church can control the flow of information is ludicrous. So we have to figure out a way to be able to confront these issues head on and still be able to maintain our faith and have a rich and exciting faith life. And if I couldn't do that, I would not remain a member of the church. But I think the first thing we need to do in order to take that step is to reach out to people who have left and not say, you need to come back because you're sinners, but say, we love you. We are your friends. You are children of God. We share a common legacy and a common heritage. We are interpreting that legacy and heritage differently, but we love each other, and we are able to be able to build something. And so that's where I hope to go. I don't hope to convince any of you who have left the church, any of you who disagree with me to agree with me. I hope that you can demonstrate, you can recognize that, you know, maybe all of these Mormons who have stayed aren't all jerks or aren't all deluded idiots, that there is a way to be able to interpret these facts differently than the way I have. So that's my presentation, and I thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Okay.
So I've been paying attention to a lot of things in like the ex-Mormon spaces and, you know, the Sunset space, and I've been trying to understand what is it that, you know, causes some people to just completely jump out and
right.
some people to kind of stay with alternative perspectives, and, you know, like Sunset is proof that there is more than one way to Mormon. And it seems to me that at a fundamental level, there is the adversarial relationship that causes people to think, I either have to believe all one way or I must completely leave.
Right.
It doesn't come in a vacuum. It is taught and socialized by people's church experience itself. And so whenever people come up with alternative ways, like many people on this list of, you know, here's how I stay, blah, 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 here are my explanations, then the easy response is, but that's not what the church is teaching. That's not what I can take in my Sunday school. That's not what I could say in Sunday school without getting chastised, you know, reprimanded by my own ward, by my own family. And so a lot of the pain that exists, how can you say that you can do anything about it when you are not the leadership and you are even noting yourself that even, you know, leaders in general conferences are saying things that don't really help in this consensus building effort? How can people who don't have the authority to, you know, make doctrine or to make the lesson plans, who aren't CES themselves,
right,
address the crisis caused by that kind of thinking?
That's a great question. I should note that I sit pretty close to church leadership because I'm one of the newest members of the Tabernacle Choir. So, you know, except for I sometimes think, I'm this close, I could probably take somebody out. But that's a terrible thing to say. No, that is a legitimate and entirely appropriate question. And I think you're absolutely right. I think that is how we've been socialized. I think it's how I was socialized. And I think the CES letter is an entirely legitimate response to that kind of socialization. And I think slowly and painfully and haltingly it is beginning to change. And I think the only way it can change is if people continue to hang in there and do things about it. In this documentary, you know John Gustav Rathall? Just stepped down as the effort. One of the quotes that he gives is he says, if you love LGBTQ people and you need to stay in this church because you are the ones who are going to make this a hospitable place for LGBTQ people. And he says, so does the church love LGBTQ people? I don't know. Are you the church? And I see that as the approach. And I think, I mean, I look at the disaster of the November 2015 policy as an example of this. I think that's the first time in my lifetime where you saw really faithful members publicly kind of say, there's something wrong with this. And eventually it changed. Now, the way it changed was obnoxious. There was no apology. There was no recognition. It was, oh, yes, this was Revelation 3 years ago. Oh, it's Revelation now. And the end. Right? Well, I find that frustrating, and I've said so, but it also changed. And eventually, the church is going to change because it has no choice but to change.
Yeah, the example of John Gustav Rathall actually is one of my points. It's great to say, you know, does the LDS Church love LGBT people? And John goes and attends, but he is excommunicated.
Right.
And he cannot be
right.
Brought back by the efforts of anyone but leadership who changes policies that excommunicate. You know, he's a faithful person who wants to engage in the church, and yet, you know, there's an institutional block on this.
No question.
Lots of people in this room wanted to make church work, but when they raised their questions in their own ward environments, in their own families, they were pushed out. The example that you mentioned of the person, you know, who was found guilty of second degree murder, he was kicked out of his house.
Right.
Those are things that are happening in the church that create an adversarial relationship. It's not starting from ex-Mormons. It's starting from the church itself, and then ex-Mormons are just living and giving tit for tat because of how we've been treated.
I can't argue with that, and I don't want to argue with that. I also find the idea of who started it to be largely irrelevant. I mean, I really do. You're right. The church isn't where it needs to be. I agree with that. I don't think the church is going to get where it needs to be if everybody leaves and abandons it. Which is fine. I personally feel called to stay in this church. I know John Gustav Rathall feels the same way. And I fully respect those who don't, right? But you look at this and, you know, the criticism about the policy, for instance, was, oh, this isn't Revelation. This is just them responding to the membership. Okay. What if it is? Isn't that a good thing? It means that eventually we won this one to a certain degree, very grudgingly, with this weird kind of non-apology nonsense. But it means that this terrible policy, with all of its terrible ramifications, including your neighbor. I can't tell you. I don't see a victory in. The victory is that the policy has been reversed, and the church still has a long, 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 long way to go. And you've still got kids killing themselves. Go ahead. Thank you for coming. That's fine. Thanks.
So, am I here? Okay. I just want to express appreciation for the kind of things you're doing, because my personal experience was the loudest voices were the same voices that are smacking down Terrell Givens and David Bakavoy and Brian Hoglid, and those are the loudest voices with the most money, and the kind of polemics that you shared with Jeremy Reynolds are the kind of polemics that someone in a vulnerable, grieving state seeking answers, going to who we perceive represent the church as their best apologists, that's the polemics that we get greeted with. And I think that people enjoyed your response, but there was sarcasm there.
Sure. Too,
but it certainly wasn't with the degree of polemics that we see with the most heavily funded, heavily promoted. The church funds either directly or indirectly. And you're caught in the middle, and Sunstone is a place that we're struggling to have money to do the
right
things we're doing. I just want to express appreciation that, you know, I think Spencer Fluman is doing some good things, and then I perceive that Elder Holland went and did a smackdown at the Maxwell Institute, you know? So I don't have a lot of faith that what you're doing is going to move things in my lifetime, but I want to express that I admire what you're trying to do.
That's very kind of you. I appreciate that, and I appreciated our interaction online. I think you've been very thoughtful in terms of how you've approached your own faith journey. I know that the church is happy with my CES letter reply. That's come through unofficial channels. I don't know if they were happy with it initially, and maybe it's because it's nastier than I think it is. But I understand where you are. I think there is more movement bubbling up than people recognize, and I have a little more faith that there will be change, and in my lifetime. I understand. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for your comments. I come here a few to agree that in a certain sense, because the church promotes, there's only one interpretation of all
right.
these things, that they're in a sense creating the Jeremy Reynolds and the Ed Deckers and the Mike Nortons and so forth, that were sort of opposite. And if that's the case, first of all, do you agree? And second of all, is there something the church can do differently, even its missionary work, to not just tell the pretty picture that only interprets things the way the church wants? And thirdly, if the church were to just put out all the information to potential converts, would they get any?
I got 2 minutes. Sam, Jetty, stand up and wave to everybody. These are my two sons. They're leaving on missions to Argentina at the end of this month. And so I've thought quite a bit about what the church can do in terms of its missionary program. I think the church's missionary program is state-of-the-art for 1965. And I think that there are a lot of things that need to change for a number of reasons. The church is putting all of the information out. Church is publishing the Gospel Talk essays, they're publishing the Joseph Smith papers, and you can roll your eyes and say, well, yeah, but they're not really promoting them, and that's true, and I would rather they did. But the fact is, the church is moving in a direction not necessarily because everybody involved is wonderful and perfect and marvelous. It's because they have no choice, right? There is no way to keep this information bottled up. And so if we keep that information out there and we don't get any converts, we're going to find that out eventually. Because eventually there is really no way to be able to put the genie back in the bottle. And so the approach has to be, the church's survival approach has to be, okay, this information is out there. How do we deal with it? How do we address it? And you're seeing the first phase of this. And I don't know, who was it that said, first they ridicule you, and then they ignore, first they ignore you, then they ridicule you, then they fight you, and then you win? I mean, the church right now is, I think, in the fighting stage. We ignored people who had these kind of faith crises before. We just, it's all anti-Mormon nonsense, don't pay any attention to it. And now we're kind of fighting them in the wrong way. Eventually, consensus, kindness, Christ-like approach to each other, that's what has to win, and that's what will win.